Right. The session's starting right now at 10 o'clock. I have the amendments on this bill. What I'd like to do is that I'd like to have a work session both Monday and Tuesday evening on workman's comp. Glenn, how are you then? Okay. Okay.
It just means on this meeting up in Portland that I'd just assume miss it.
Okay, I'm going to take them in reverse order. Tuesday night, there will be a work session on House Bill 2237, Senate Bill 1050, House Bill 2658, and Senate Bill 1048. On Monday night, there will be a work session on House Bill 3123, 3164, Senate Bill 310. I don't think we've had a public hearing on Senate Bill 302. Mm-mm. And I will probably add a couple more bills to that work session.
You could put 302 on Monday because you're taking... Do you want the 310 on the work session for Monday morning to be moved over to the evening?
Yes. I will add some others to the work session on Monday night. I assure the committee that not like last Thursday when we went until 11:30, that I will guarantee you that the work session will end at 10 o'clock sharp, and you're all entitled to get up and walk out if I run it past that on me. Okay, is there anything else to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.
House Labor Committee. Monday, June 6th, public hearing on Senate Bill 474, 727 and 297, and a work session on Senate Bill 882 and 3139.
The committee will come to order. The clerk will note those present. All others are excused. Let me tell you that as to 297, that Senate Bill 297 is on the agenda today, that Representative Otto and myself, it's not a subcommittee, it's just an informal work thing to try to get the parties together, because there seems to be somewhat of a degree of unanimity on the principal features of that bill, but it's just the language we're having difficulty with, so I doubt if I get to it today. But we will set up a meeting so we can talk to all the parties to make sure that we understand each other. First bill on the agenda is Senate Bill 474. Jan, do I have the plan of peace? Committee members, and I've had a number of requests to have a night hearing for this bill through the number of state employees. I have no problem with that if I can fit it into my agenda. If you note that we have a committee hearing tonight, tomorrow night, and we're going to be setting night hearings in on the workman's compensation issue. I consider that probably one of the principal issues still facing the legislature, and I would like this committee to spend their time in the evenings on that issue. I am going to attempt to see if it's at all possible to accommodate some of the requests that I've had, but at this time, I'm reserving the hearings in the evening for the workman's comp issues. Go ahead, Mr. Miller.
Caroline Miller. I'm here representing the Oregon Federation of Teachers and the Portland Federation of Teachers. I want to apologize to the committee this morning that I have no typed testimony because I have been at our Teacher State Convention all weekend. Fortunately, I have discussed the bill broadly.
Excuse me.
Oh, yes.
Can everyone hear all right? Maybe you should pull that mic a little closer. It isn't coming through too loud, did they?
Fortunately, I have discussed the bill broadly, first in the Senate and now in the House, and have distributed several written statements regarding our position so that it's my hope that our objections are reasonably familiar to the committee, and I will provide just a brief summary of why we object to the bill. We object to Senate Bill 474 for three major reasons. One, we feel that the bill might cause unnecessary strikes in the public sector because it forces, by incorporating the fair share issue in the negotiated contract, it forces the employee to reject the entire contract in order to reject an unfair fair share fee. Thus, the employee has to put himself in a position of strike against his employer in order to oppose a position taken by his bargaining agent. Number two, the second reason we oppose this bill is that there are times when the bargaining agent represents, in terms of an organization, a minority group. Since fair share is defined in the current law as in lieu of dues fees, this means that a minority group can set its membership fees and pass those fees on to a disenfranchised majority. And the third reason we oppose this bill is that we feel that it enters into or affects a jurisdictional dispute between two opposing teacher unions, an issue which we feel would be better left at the ballot box. Now that I've presented the committee with our summary of objections, not explanations, because I have talked to most of you, or one of our representatives has, I would like to take this opportunity to address myself to certain arguments raised by those who have supported the bill. The first point I wish to stress, it's a rumor that I have not been able to assuage, that I am standing here representing the Oregon Federation of Teachers as well as my local. I have distributed among you a letter from Shirley Gold, which authorizes me to speak on behalf of the state teacher organization. I think it's safe to say that the Oregon Federation of Teachers' interest in this bill stems from the fact that the Portland Federation of Teachers is essentially the parent organization for the state and provides the bulk and substantial funds of money to maintain the state organization. Number two, I would like to address some points to a letter written by lobbyist Bill Wyatt from the Oregon State Employees Association dated May 26th. There are some issues raised in this letter to which I would like to respond. The first point that I would like to make is that contrary to Bill's assertions, neither the OFT nor the PFT has ever objected to the concept of fair share. As he rightly points out in his letter, it was our international, the American Federation of Teachers, that defended this concept before the United States Supreme Court. What we do object strenuously to is the incorporation of the fair share fee directly as a single vote issue in the negotiated contract. Bill justifies putting the employee in a position where he must cut off his nose to spite his face, that is, where he must put himself in a potential position of strike with his employer in order to object to fair share by stating the following, and I quote from his May 26th letter. In our experience, it is not at all uncommon to see an employee support us in a representation election and then refuse to join because all the representation services must be provided anyway. We do not feel that the record shows that employees must be coerced into accepting a fair share fee when a contract is fair and equitable and the costs are realistic. Our competing organization, the Oregon Education Association, has been successful in winning fair share agreements through a democratic process in almost every major city in this state. To name a few, Oregon City, Corvallis, Eugene, Salem, Tigard, Beaverton. To continue, we do not now nor ever have objected, as Bill's letter implies, to the OEA amendment which deals with the question of ratification. We do not quarrel that the majority vote should be the majority of those voting. We only object to the single vote issue. Bill discounts our concern for the single vote issue in his letter of May 26th with the following argument, and I quote again, there are over 40 clauses in our existing contract with the state of Oregon.
Excuse me.
Go ahead, Karen.
Who are you quoting from now?
I'm quoting from Bill Wyatt's letter of May 26th.
Oh, okay. I understood you to say May 26th, and the copy I have says May 27th, so I thought I was on the wrong one.
My copy says May 26th. And again, I'm quoting, there are over 40 clauses in our existing contract with the state of Oregon. How equitable is it then that we must ratify only fair share as a separate matter as opposed to salaries, vacations, overtime, transfer policy, or the myriad of other issues embraced within the contract? In other words, Bill is asking what makes the fair share clause so different that it should be treated in a separate vote. I would like to answer him quite simply. All of the items listed above deal with work and economic issues that affect employer-employee relationships. Representing the worker in these matters is the collective bargaining agent elected to serve the interest of the employee. But in the matter of fair share, it is the interest of the collective bargaining agent that is served and not necessarily that of the worker. In this case, who protects the employee and the non-member employees in particular from levying fees which are exorbitant? We feel that without the right to vote on fair share as an item separate from the contract, there is no protection from the excessive demands of a bargaining agent. For this reason, we maintain it is unwise to amend the current law, which does provide for separate votes. To remove that right is to open a Pandora's box of potential abuse where a conflict of interest exists.
Can I ask you a question?
Surely.
You have a right to vote on the fair share under the present law.
Yes.
That isn't what Herb's held.
Well, we have been voting on fair share separately from the contract.
That's because that the bargaining agent wants to, but I don't think that's true. I think if you read the Oregon City case, they said that specifically, in fact, that there's nothing in the law that requires a secret ballot election or even an election in that matter. It just said such opinion shall reflect the majority opinions of the members of the bargaining unit. That opinion's expressed, the court's silent on it, and it doesn't say that it has to have an election.
I'd like to quote from a letter from John Danielson, May 17, 1977, to Senator Wally Carson. You may be very right, Representative Kulongowski, but I would like, in that case, to enter the following OEA explanation of the current law.
Is it the law or the practice?
I would let Mr. Danielson's words speak for themselves.
How about leaving a copy of that letter with us, would you?
Yes, I'd be glad to do that. Do you want me to read it,
then? Yes, go right ahead.
The court decision last year in Oregon City was determined, it was determined that some procedure must be established whereby a clear demonstration is made to show that a fair share agreement reflects the majority opinion. The court was not clear on how this should be done. Consequently, a variety of methods, including a petitioning procedure and a ratification vote, have been used. The court has also determined that the assurance would have to be provided separately each time a new contract became effective. That is the issue, Representative Kulongowski. Some form of separate ratification.
But that didn't mean a vote.
I will accept that correction. Shall I go on?
Please.
We feel then that it is the conflict of issue in the bargaining agent negotiating its own fees without some form of ratification on the part of the bargaining unit that is the key issue in this legislation and should not, must not, and cannot be confused with the concept of union shop where workers are all members of the same union and as such do have a direct vote on dues fees. This is a distinction which has been very difficult for our brothers and sisters in the AFL to understand. To put it quite simply, among teacher organizations, there are those of us who wish to remain in the mainstream of the AFL-CIO movement, and there are those of us who wish to remain separate. Those of us who cherish our AFL-CIO affiliations will pay the cost of fair share, but we will not go gently into that good night by being taxed to the full extent of membership dues by an organization that remains outside of the AFL-CIO. And this brings me to my final point. Are we right to maintain that the fair share fee should be something less than the approximate of membership dues? For that answer, in the light of the recent Supreme Court rulings, we turned for legal advice and sought the opinion of Robert Jordan, a Portland attorney. The committee has now copies of his letter to me, but I wish to read into the record paragraphs 3, 4, and 5. This is the opinion of attorney Robert Jordan, Portland, Oregon. The majority held, this is the Supreme Court decision, the majority held fair share permissible, but only if the amount of the share was proportional to the amount of the bargaining representative's budget devoted exclusively to collective bargaining related issues. All of the justices agreed that non-member assessments could not be used to fund political activities by the bargaining representative. Three justices would have held fair share by public employees always unconstitutional. One, that the case was prematurely before the court, or that the majority decision was too broad. The court did not decide how non-member rights should be protected, nor did it offer much assistance in distinguishing between political activities and economic activities, since those problems were not before the court. In summation, the public employee fair share agreements are permissible infringements on the right of free association only so long as exactions from non-members are not used to promote political causes, candidates, or issues, but are only used to contribute to the funding of the collective bargaining process on a pro rata basis with members. This would indicate that ORS 243.650 subsection 16, which permits non-member contributions to equal dues and assessments, may well be unconstitutional, at least in part, since a heavy proportion of dues to most local organizations go to parent bodies which have no role in the locals' collective bargaining activities. It also appears that Oregon's fair share law may be unconstitutional in that it fails to provide any procedures and safeguards which would limit the use of fair share exactions for constitutionally permissible purposes. We, the Oregon Federation of Teachers and the Portland Federation of Teachers, feel that in the light of this legal opinion of the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision on fair share, feel and urge the members of this committee to table Senate Bill 474 and to seek an Attorney General's opinion on the constitutionality of the current law. Then and only then will the legal consequences of Senate Bill 474 be clear. I thank the committee for its indulgence.
To the members of the committee, I've read the legal memorandum, and I'm going to put it at this particular spot. It's completely erroneous and wrong in its analysis of the Abood case as to what the dissent was and what I think that the letter, as it's framed, even implies. One, it had nothing to do so much with care in this whole range of union security agreements. It was an agency shop agreement, which is somewhat different. Now, we can argue back and forth what it means, but all I'm going to tell you is that in my opinion, what the letter says and what the case held is not correct. I do not believe that the case held what Mr. Jordan says it held. Now, I understand his position on it, but the fact is that the dissent did not take that position. And it's a burden, and it's a constitutional burden on the local organization to use whatever dues it gets for the purposes of collective bargaining or contract administration. His analysis that the money goes to the state or international organizations, and therefore is not used for collective bargaining, is completely wrong, because the court in that opinion recognized the per capita dues concept and what the technical advice that a local organization needs from its state and its international. The case is much broader than just the public sector. And I think that most people that have read it and have analyzed it correctly recognize that the court answered a series of questions that were coming up through the private sector rather than the public sector, and that is the role of a labor organization, what it can do with the dues of a member, of an employee, a member of the bargaining unit who is not a member of the union. And I think that the case has far-ranging implications in that area, and what it basically provides is there has to be a rebate procedure.
For that which is not used for collective bargaining?
Yes, where the majority and the minority got split up is the minority basically would say that it's upon the union to prove what the use of the money is going for as far as which is political and which is for collective bargaining, and the majority opinion, to my understanding, did not agree with that and said the burden is still upon the member to come in and ask for a rebate, saying that you're using my dues for non-collective bargaining reasons. But this whole area is very, very broad of what are political and non-political functions. And that issue has never been resolved yet. And as far as how much of it is entitled to a rebate. Now, Caroline, let me ask you a question. It's a non-legal question. Here's the thing. As I understand it, your concern is is that you be given an opportunity to vote or indicate your concern for the fair share independently from the collective bargaining agreement.
Yes.
That's the whole issue. Let me ask you, how many units of the Federation across the United States have agency shop agreements?
I do not. Well, I can answer that to my knowledge. The only one I know that has an agency shop agreement is the Detroit case.
And what was the amount of dues paid in that case?
I do not know.
Were health care practitioners full dues? And that you don't know how much it was, though?
No, I do not.
But it is the question of indicating whether you want it or don't want it. Let me ask you this. Do you know, to your knowledge, in any other area of collective bargaining, are the employees entitled in the private sector, let's say, to a private vote on the amount of the union security, the security clause or the amount of the dues?
I'm not a member of the private sector, Representative Kulongowski, so I don't have any ability to answer that question. I would like to contribute, however.
Okay. And
I do not wish to cross swords with you, as I am an English teacher and not a lawyer. I would like to point out, however, that there is another legal opinion that has been entered on the part of another Portland lawyer with whom I have nothing to do with, who agrees with Robert Jordan's position. I believe that may be forthcoming.
Do you have that letter?
I do not. I believe Representative Starr may have it. I'm not sure. My point is...
From Mark McClanahan. From what attorney?
Mark McClanahan.
Who?
Mark McClanahan. In any case, my point is I think the area is one which would be subject to a great deal of legal opinion, and perhaps the Attorney General's ruling would be appropriate in this matter.
Thank you, Caroline.
No, I don't have that letter.
Perhaps I can get a copy. I know it exists.
Oh, would probably be helpful if I had it.
Thank you.
Mr. Stafford Hansel? Stafford, would you care if I brought Bill Holzer up with you? Bill?
What?
Yeah, no, I'm going to make him.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Stafford Hansel, director of the Executive Department, and the last thing that I want to do this morning is to get caught between two unions who apparently disagree on this legislation, or to get trapped into exchanging legal opinions with the chairman of the committee, who I certainly do not do, and I'm glad to have Mr. Holzer here with me.
I'm going to get in with Mr. Holzer.
All right. I'm just going to oppose this on the basis that it's the wrong way to go, that it has two very definite flaws over the existing. The single vote where you're voting, forced to vote if you want increases in salaries for a union shop, and your option is no increase or no agreement, and the possibility of the distinct possibility that there would be continuing problems in the sector as a result of this. The other one, and I'm sure that you're going to talk to Mr. Holzer about this, has to do with the inability of employees, once they are under the management and the representative have agreed to an agreement, that the employees themselves have no opportunity to vote out of such an agreement. And that once it's in, no matter what kind of abuses are in it, in contrast to the private sector, where they're protected by the National Labor Board Act, and that they can have a decertification after 30% of the people sign a petition, and a secret election as a result of that. And that becomes a safety valve in the private sector that, as I read this bill, is not here. And I think that this itself would contribute to a considerable amount of controversy among employees and could lead to disruption of a very, the very fine relationships between management and labor in the public sector. I view this as not a productive change in our existing law. I think that the existing law works well, and we're learning how to work with it. This kind of a situation takes off the bargaining table some of the things that management and labor should be negotiating on, and I just think it's a poor bill and that you should change it. Now, if you were going to seriously consider passing this out, which I'm sure you are, I would like to suggest that there be some amendments made to it. And I'll...
Thank you, Stafford, for your bluntness.
I think so.
So that's actually a third element that's added to this. amendment rather than the one just on the fair share. And it would now...
It requires a vote.
That's right. It would now require a vote on the collective bargaining agreement separate and apart from the issue of fair share. I mean, if there was going to be a fair share agreement, there would have to be a vote on the full collective bargaining agreement.
That's correct.
Representative, if I could just offer this from a purely legal standpoint, not lobbying this bill one way or the other, I think the way you wrote the original act was pretty good. And I think it's gotten screwed up since then by the amendments that were made last session and the amendment that's proposed here. As you remember, the amount of fair share was to be determined by the Employment Relations Board if the employer and the union did not determine it. And the board, of course, threw up its hands at what was an overwhelming burden of work, and so they supported the amendment that said if the employer and the union don't agree, then it's the same as union dues. So many unions, of course, will fail to agree on anything other than union dues. I haven't read the Supreme Court case yet, other than the reports that I've received, but it's obvious that full union dues is not going to sell one way or the other, whether the employee initiates the action or whether the union must come forward. You have a problem when you try to remove this ratification language in that you have no deauthorization procedure as you have in the private sector.
Well, let me go back one before you get on to that. It raises a question in my mind. I agree with you as far as the requiring the rebate procedure, you know, as the UAW has right now, and I think a number of labor organizations, at least on the international level, have recommended that be implemented. If, in fact, the policy question is that if, in fact, that there is a rebate procedure, do you believe that it should be the state and its agencies that get involved in the determination of what is political and non-political, or do you think, as the court said, in which I think you're correct, that there's a constitutional question in here, that it's upon the labor organization internally to provide for the rebate procedure and handle this matter themselves?
The bill, as you originally wrote it, had the employer into the procedure, at least to the extent that if the employer and the union could agree, if not, then it went to the Employment Relations Board. I think it would probably be better to get the employer out of it and give it back to the Employment Relations Board to make determinations based on the actual financial statements of the union. I don't know how you could leave it to the union and the employees to negotiate.
Well, it isn't Bill, the problem is, one, you recognize one of the problems with the administrative burden, but besides that, the employee has a right, it's a constitutional right now, and regardless what an administrative agency decision makes, and you know, and you read that dissent, and that's the major issue in the dissent on who the burden is upon, whether it's upon the labor organization or it's upon the individual to claim political activity and provide for it. And the majority clearly states it's on the employee. Now, that's where the minority says, listen, we think we would reverse it just around backwards. And we'd say it's the labor organization's problem. But the question I still have for you, I don't agree with you. I'm going to tell you this, that the state should be involved in it, in that determination of political activity versus collective bargaining.
I say I would keep the state out of it, that is to say the employer out of it, and give it to the Employment Relations Board.
Well, I consider the Employment Relations Board the state. I don't distinguish between that agency and the state of Oregon.
I think that you might make a mistake if you leave it to the union and the employees to battle it out in the courts exclusively with no administrative remedy or no administrative way of handling the matter expeditiously.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
In that case, was it up to the employee to determine the amount or just leave the battle?
He would have to make a claim that they're using
the amount. Are you saying making a claim in an amount of money, or?
I think it not so much an amount as it would be for the purposes of which the money went. It would appear to me that the employee would never know how much money, dollar figure, is actually spent. But he could make the allegation, and he could put it in a sum of an estimate. But he's going to have to be able to say that the money is being spent for political activity, to wit, and then say that it's being used for that purpose.
Then the union is going to end up making the determination of how much anyway, even though the burden rests on the employee.
Yes. And he doesn't, what happens, let me put it this way, it's a rebate procedure that it's a percentage they take. If I understand the UAW proposal, and I read that some time ago again, Bill, they determine how much money is spent for political activity in a particular area. They know how many members and how much money each member pays, and then they give it a percentage. The employee gets a percentage rebate. And you know what they found out? That it comes out to something like sometimes 50 cents or 75 cents or something like that. For that particular activity, but they itemize it very closely as to where it's going. And that's what it's going to require the labor organizations to do, is to, under that case, and I think that they're all being advised of that now, is to itemize exactly where the money's going, for what purpose. And then the second question is whether that particular purpose is political or non-political, or it's in the area, you know, if it's needed in the area of collective bargaining.
Does this only apply to, well, like in the case of a fair share of non-members or modified agency shop non-members,
no.
Or does it apply to any member or non-member who is contributing? I mean, if I'm a member and I'm paying my full union dues and I've signed on the line, but if I still disagree with making contributions to political campaigns, can I apply or can I ask for the rebate?
I believe that you can, because it applies to every member. And see, what happens, see, is you got to understand it. There are different forms of union security agreement. And you take the first is the union shop, which is all the members belong to the labor organization, and they have the right to object. Then you have the agency shop provision, which they all pay the same as. And that was the Sabood case out of Detroit that Ms. Miller talked about. They have an agency shop. And then there's an argument of whether the fair share is somewhat analogous to the agency shop agreement, or below that, and then you've got another creature they call
modified agency shop.
Maintenance of membership. Maintenance of membership agreement.
Yeah.
And I think that every member under that Supreme Court case has the right now, as far as general fund dollars that they pay to their dues, and the general fund is of the union, to inquire of whether that money is being spent for political activity. And you know what? What's the interesting question, Gary, in this whole area, is that most labor organizations now have political action on them, in which those are voluntary contributions. And then they set up that as a separate fund, and I don't think there's a question on that, because they voluntarily agree to pay, and it says, I'm going to contribute $5 for political activity. What they're talking about is if your dues are $10 a month, $120 a year, that goes into what they call the general fund or the general treasury of the union. It's that money
for $5
and what it's being used for is an issue.
So $7 or $5 is going to be over and above the 10.
Yeah, it's above the 10, and I don't think there's any question on that as far as what they use, because they say that that's a voluntary checkoff. Isn't that right, Bill? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think many organizations, I think even OSCA has such a fund. The difficulty is that since the finances are not made public, I haven't the faintest idea whether Mr. Wyatt's paid out of that fund or out of the general fund. There's another piece of legislation kicking around to have state labor organizations report. I don't know where that legislation goes. Representative, before you get away, I simply want to repeat that the amendment that Mr. Hassel has offered is the alternative to having fair share agreement ratified in the first instance. That is to say, if you're not going to allow the employees to ratify in the first instance, then it's in the nature of the deauthorization procedure that is allowed in the private sector to allow employees to escape the agreement if they feel it's unfair, the amounts are incorrect.
Well, let me ask you, do you know of any other state where they have a separate vote on either in the public or the private sector on the question of union security? Or the amount, the agreement, but on the amount.
I'm sorry, I haven't ever researched that, Representative. I can't give you an answer.
Let me ask you this. Hawaii, which this concept came from, you know, is fair share, do they require the ratification of the fair share agreement separately? It's in the collective bargaining agreement, I think. But what happens is that the Employment Relations Board in Hawaii determines the amount of it.
Well, you wrote your original bill on the Hawaiian concept, and it seems to me that that original concept, as interpreted by the Court of Appeals in the Oregon City case, said essentially it just isn't fair to have the fair share agreement ratified at the same time as the collective bargaining agreement, if you have the collective bargaining agreement ratified, because obviously an employee might wish to take the dollar and cents of the collective bargaining agreement, but not wish to agree to the particular amount of fair share.
William, their unfairness was in light of the statute. I don't think there was anything in there that said inherently it's unfair. It was in light of the statutory language.
Well, it seems to me that Senate Bill 474 is, you know, flies directly into the face of that decision, and if you do adopt that bill, you ought to adopt the kind of amendment that Mr. Hansel has given you to give employees an escape hatch.
Stafford, you have anything else?
Nope.
It's a tough issue. I know. I understand that the employers, I understand the employees, I understand that the labor organizations.
I just can't see the need of it.
You know, Bill, I might tell you that the Abood case once again goes into the free rider definition, which they picked up years ago and said that the labor organizations have a legitimate interest in preventing or in some way limiting the free riders. And which they found out, they picked up a lot of the language out of the Orlin-Scott case and just brought it in. Thank you, Stafford.
Thank you.
Mr. Danielson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Danielson. I reside at 9500 Southwest Greenberg Road in Tigard, and I'm representing the Oregon Education Association. And I would say that Senate Bill 474 was introduced on our behalf by the Labor Committee in the Oregon Senate. But I'd like to go back to the very fundamental aspects of this and take a look at the existing law compared to what the amendments would do, because I think we've talked a lot about the concepts of fair share without really looking at what the situation is at present and how it would change as it relates to this particular situation. Following that, I would like to comment briefly concerning some of the comments that are made by the PFT, and then, of course, to make a few other arguments that we think are good reasons as to why this particular proposal should be enacted. First of all, under the existing law, the language says that a fair share agreement in the definition section, that such agreement shall reflect the opinion of a majority of the employees in the bargaining unit. And the proposal would change it so that the validation would come with a majority vote of the entire bargaining contract. Now, it's an interesting bit of language, and it's unique language in terms of collective bargaining statutes across this country in the existing statute, because fair share is not an item that is considered separately when looking at the collective bargaining contracts. It is an argument that is included right in along with the rest. And I might say, from the experiences that I've had at the bargaining table, it is a do-or-die item to many employers who fear that a fair share contract might fund a public employee union sufficiently so that they can become more effective in the bargaining process. And as a consequence of that, they have fought this bitterly, giving up virtually anything else rather than a fair share contract. I would also like to comment that if you are going to negotiate the fair share contract, then I think it's also necessary that you should treat that with the rest of the contract, because it's a matter of give and take in the bargaining process. You give over here and take over here. And that's the way it is all the way through bargaining. You take a little bit in fringe, you give up a little bit in salary. You may get a little bit on this policy, you give up a little bit on this policy. That's the process of bargaining. That's the process in legislation, which is effectively a negotiations process. So that, in effect, is what we've done. Now, after the Oregon City decision, which has been referred to here, I think we were quoted slightly on some of the commentary that we delivered for Senator Carson when he carried this bill on the floor of the Senate. And we indicated that the Oregon City decision left us somewhat confused as to what was really desirable in terms of ratification of a fair share agreement. And that is that there was no definitive procedure there, and it simply said that such agreement shall reflect the opinion of a majority of employees in the bargaining unit. And this effectively was giving franchise to people that didn't vote on the question, and I would say that many times you have really even a plurality voting on a union contract, particularly if it's a summer ratification, and even though the opportunity is there. And whether or not a petitioning procedure, we've used a petitioning procedure, petitioned out. We find that if you may not be able to get the whole number to vote on the question, or a sufficient number to vote, you may have a 7-3 vote in favor of the contract. You may have 49% of the eligible employees in the unit that have voted in the affirmative on the question. So we've used a petitioning process. At any rate, we're not certain just exactly what would hold up and what would not hold up, because the language has no precedent, and it is indeed difficult then to operate in that kind of situation. So Senate Bill 474 was introduced with the idea of clarifying this situation. It was also recognized that in some units across the state, that there is no ratification of the contract by the employees, but instead it's an executive board action, or it's an action of the members in the unit only. And so we felt that for protection of our members where we don't have units, and for protection of people generally, that it should be necessary that every eligible employee, and that meaning anybody that's in the bargaining unit, whether or not they are members of a particular organization, that they should in fact be allowed to vote on the question. They should in fact be allowed to vote whether or not that contract is going to be ratified. And so we felt that if this is done, then of course it should be also statutory. By our policy we do it. Of course we have no ability to control the actions of other organizations. So we think then that the law moves favorably in two directions. It clarifies the ratification procedure for fair share, something that has been left confused by the courts. And secondly, it guarantees all public employees that they will have a voice in the ratification of the bargaining contract. Now, we've heard some charges against this, that it's going to put the PFT out of business, and that it's going to cause unnecessary strikes, and that it's going to it's a difficult situation where a bargaining unit represents a minority, and I'd like to address all three of those points. I think it was pointed out by the spokesman for the AFT that we have effected fair share agreements in Beaverton, in Eugene, in Salem, in Medford, and in a variety of other cities in the state, most of the larger ones. And one of the reasons that we're able to do that is because we had a substantial voluntary membership in those organizations. Our membership ranged probably 80 to 85% voluntary, on up to in Bend, where we ran 92% voluntary. But and nevertheless, even in Bend, took us 2 or 3 years before we could effect a fair share agreement, even with a voluntary membership that was over 90%. And the thing that finally sold it in Bend was the fact that the required services that we have to perform by law were taking about 20% of the funding for bargaining from the non-payers, and finally the payers, and looking at this statistic, finding that they were giving disproportionate service to non-members, which is, I might add, coincidental,
decided that maybe they too ought to be paying. So they did affect that on the other eight people. We have a fair share in the Central Lynn School District. And in the process, we had a 53-member organization there, or 51-member organization. We picked up two additional people. So it isn't really a situation here that's going to cause the Oregon Education Association to pick up a lot of new fair share districts. It's not true at all. The question of fair share is not on the table presently in Portland. And we have an organization there of slightly in excess of 1,200 people. The AFT has about 600. And I suspect they're somewhere in the range of 1,200 that are affiliated with a couple of old traditional groups. I think the High School Teachers Association, the Grade Teachers Association, which are not competitive in the bargaining process. So effectively, then, our membership in Portland ranges probably slightly below 40% of those eligible. And I would tell any of you that have been involved in the negotiations process or at all involved in organizations that we're not going to have a fair share agreement in Portland. It's just that simple. Until we can get our membership probably up almost double what it is at the present time on a voluntary basis. Now, our program says maybe down the road we're going to be able to do that. I can't tell you how long it's going to be. We were tremendously successful in accelerating our membership, which I might add we have not been over the last 3 or 4 years. We've picked up some, but not in the kind of magnitude we would need. Then I think in the foreseeable future that we would be able to effect possibly a fair share agreement in Portland. And we are reorganizing in Portland. We are attempting to do more there. But I would point out to you that in Portland, and we've heard the PFT say that the PFT in Portland is the base of the state organization. And in the mailing or the letter that they sent to you, they said that their funds there are necessary to assist them in those units where they are bargaining. And I would point out to you that we have to treat Portland like a 3,000-member organization because we have to provide the contract services, the grievances, for all 3,000 of those people, the legal affairs, the whole thing, everything that a member gets except their right to vote is afforded to a fair share member. And as a consequence then, Portland is a red ink operation for us. We recognize that. And some of our other units are probably subsidizing us to there to some point. But we're at the same time, PFT says, well, we need the money. Their dues are as high as ours in Portland. And they say they need the money to subsidize downstate. And we're saying simply that somewhere there should be a clear process where we should have the opportunity to affect a fair share in Portland. Now, we've heard also comments that about union security agreements and how this is different. And I would say that if you talk to anybody in the AFL-CIO, perhaps outside of the public sector, although AFSCME has gone on the record, I think, for this particular bill, but if you do talk to these other people, you'd say, well, what kind of a union security agreement do you believe that you should have? And they say, well, definitely we should have a union shop. A union shop is an agreement whereby you hire members of the union. Then you have agreements going down whereby an individual is required to join the union after 30 days on the job. Those are the kinds of union security agreements that are most common in the private sector. They are also the kind that are most desirable by the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, the Longshoremen, whatever else, and certainly the most popular. The fair share is the least desirable from their point of view because it simply allows them to pay a sum of money and in lieu of dues in order to assist in the cost of making that organization function. And the theory of that is that if you share in the benefits, if you are guaranteed the rights of representation and grievance and litigation and other matters, that you should in fact be willing to pay your fair part of that because it is not fair to cause your colleague down the hall to make all of those payments for you. So that's the concept behind it. The same basic concepts behind it would prevail in the public sector as well as in the private sector. Okay, let's take a look at the matter of politics and what does it cost in terms of an organizational dues. Now, our dues are probably in the range of $180 to $185 a year in Portland. I would add that they're probably a little higher in Portland than in most places in the state, and the reason being because we are a minority organization and we must, in fact, pay the dues or pay the costs for people that are members of the AFT that choose not to participate in our organization and for those that choose not to join any organization. So our dues are higher there, and they're quite right in their charges there. Theirs are just high, and they have no responsibilities in the collective bargaining field there at all. We're statutorily required. But on the matter of politics,
politics, I think the courts have generally come down pretty consistently that if a member really wants his money back, that what you spend on lobbying and non-collective bargaining activities, they can. And politics, my activities, Don Satchel's activities, the activities we spend in that field, and I'm not talking about campaign contributions, are appropriate. That figure is easily derived. We're required, as anyone else is, to report that figure with the Secretary of State every year. And I think last year we spent the average somewhere in the range of about $95,000 a year in that field. We don't operate like most labor unions. We're a corporation. They're an association. There is a difference. Most labor unions do make contributions in state to political campaigns from dues money. We do not. We do it entirely from voluntary contributions. And, of course, a fair share member could, in fact, make a contribution to us for that purpose. And I would add some do, most don't. But, and we've also received, contributions from non-member units where we don't represent them in bargaining, where the people are not members either. So these contributions come across the board but aren't entirely voluntary. All right, those political contributions, if they're made, you can have refunded if you are a member or not. In other words, if they're a contribution to the campaign to elect Anita Paulson in District 31 or whatever. But the contributions for political activity, which would be lobbying and representation of the legislature, those could not be refunded upon a member's request, would be upon a non-member's request if they were involved in a fair share payment. And I think, as I say, that the record is very clear because Oregon has very clear reporting laws, and so I think you're quite on the books as to what you pay for those things. So one, we don't think it causes any unnecessary strikes. We think the record is clear. The fair share fight has been fought in most of the large school districts. And I think if you look at Oregon's record since the Public Employee Bargaining Act, you will find that we have been as clean of strikes as almost any state in this country. And I think the labor relations here have been as good as in most states in the country. And I don't think that there is anything that would defend a position that enactment of this legislation would cause any additional strikes. Now, as far as jurisdictional disputes, it says it affects jurisdictional disputes. I think you're going to have jurisdictional disputes from time to time, with or without the law. I don't think it affects them. I think simply they're going to be there. And what you do with this law doesn't have much to do with that. And we get about a 70% membership in Portland. We're probably going to try to affect the fair share agreement, whether this law passes or not. We think this clarifies where we are. It'll probably prevent some unnecessary litigation down the line. So with that, Mr. Chairman, or Vice Chairman, I'll conclude my testimony, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond to it.
Did you say that the employee that didn't choose to belong to any union could obtain his or her money back for the amount that was represented by not only the political contributions, but also the lobbying?
Oh, no, not if they don't join anything. You mean a person that doesn't pay anything in the first place?
Pay through the fair share agreement.
All right, a fair share member, yes, you have to break out those costs that are used for such things as lobbying activities that are. And I think you could make a case for saying that they are supported through the bargaining process, but generally speaking, I think we've broken it that way, and we feel our legal counsel has advised us that way. That could be refunded to them. As far as political contributions go, they wouldn't be making those in the first place.
Well, then what would be left? Just the cost of administering, just running the organization?
Well, you're entitled to administrative overhead, same way in a political party or anything else. You've got administrative costs that of course, you can't stop, and those are, of course, including the bargaining. I'm not sure of the total breakdown. The only thing I'm sure of is how it affects the politics, because I've been called in and had to break down costs and so forth for this computation. But as far as what other aspects that they could be refunded on, I can't speak specifically as an expert on that.
Yeah, okay. Representative Wilhelms?
Do you have any objections to the executive department's proposed amendment?
I have not seen their amendments. That's the first I knew they were going to present any was this morning, and I wasn't provided a copy. I would be happy to respond to them at a later time.
I'd like to know how you feel about it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Otto.
John, you mentioned that in the Portland situation, increase your membership?
Oh, I think we'll increase it, but we'll do it on a voluntary means. We're going to, we're restaffing in there. We're feeding the program. Yes, we will do that. You will increase your membership some. But you asked a different question. Will we get a fair share agreement in Portland in the next year or two? And I think the answer is no. Now, they did vote separately in Portland.
Why is that?
Why won't we?
Yeah.
Because we've only got 1,200 members out of 3,000, and the practical politics of it say they'd throw the rascals out if we tried to do that. And I think we're a little smarter than to do that. It's that simple. They tried a fair share. In their contract, they had an agreement that they would try a fair share with a separate vote. And that's the reason it was done that way in the city of Portland. That was negotiated. And then they tried it, and it lost. But I think that that is much less risk in those kind of marginal situations. But as far as, you know, we're trying to improve our organization in Portland. I don't think we want to destroy it. I think if we... I think the politics of the situation would say that unless you can, and not just in Portland, anywhere, if you haven't got 70% voluntary membership, you're taking a very, very severe risk in attempting to affect the fair share agreement among teachers. Now, I can't speak for the way other state employees feel, but I suspect they would be very much the same. You have a substantial number of teachers, at least, that are willing, quite willing to join and even participate sometimes in leadership capacities, that really are not very very heavy on the union security type causes. They would rather pay more themselves. So if you subtract that percentage out, then you've got to have probably 20-25% covering. So if 70% is probably a minimum figure, that would mean we're going to have somewhere in the range of probably 2,500 members in Portland, which is a little better than double what we've got now.
Let me ask another question then. Do you see this, if this bill would pass, do you see this as a point of controversy in school district number one from a standpoint that one organization would say, no, we will not invoke fair share? Do you think that?
Sometime down the track, you know, when we get it to the point where we think we've got a shot, we'll probably take a shot. I don't think that's going to be in the real near future, but certainly the other organization is going to oppose any fair share proposal that we have in Portland. There's no question about that. I think, however, as you look at this bill, that you ought to look at it as it affects state employees generally, rather than as it affects in the field of education, because I think that if this bill passes and we look at what happened in the collective bargaining sector in education, at least in elementary secondary, it may have a little more influence on community college, but I don't think anything's going to happen. Nothing. I mean, maybe one or two 30 or 40 teacher districts. That's about the effect of it, and that may have happened anyway. But I don't think in education you're going to see any foreseeable change as a result of this piece of legislation. I think we have done our work in the fair share, and we may litigate more because the language is ambiguous and it isn't clear, but I think in the final analysis we'll come out in about the same place. Now that's a little different perhaps in the state because they haven't really gotten into the fair share to the same extent we have.
Thank you, John.
I might make a comment.
Sorry.
I favor the fair share concept. I always relate it to three persons going into a bar room, and two of these persons buy a round of drinks, and then when it's time for the third person to buy his round of drinks, he ends up going to the restroom. And I think that's just about where we are on fair share. A lot of these people want the benefits without paying for them. The only disturbing thing to me is the fact that we could have a jurisdictional dispute. I think that the jurisdictional dispute hurts everyone.
Well, I agree with you, and we would like not to have one, but I don't think the passage of this bill or the failure of it to pass, either way, would change that situation. I think that as long as you have a 600-member organization and they're fighting for bargaining rights, and a 1,200-member organization,
and 1,200 other people that are not a member of either of the two organizations that are fighting for it, you have the potential for a jurisdictional dispute. That is indeed a unique situation in Oregon. We would like to avoid one, and hopefully we'll be able to. But I don't think I could sit here and guarantee you that we will be able to do that. But I think that's completely independent of this particular legislative proposal.
Bill?
John, is the ballot in this case always secret ballot, written ballot?
To date, there have been no restrictions whatsoever. In other words, they're not even required to ratify it. For the most part, it is.
You mean the membership?
Yes. Anybody that's a member of the bargaining unit, whether a member or not.
Okay.
All of the ones I have seen have been secret ballots, but I'm sure I haven't seen even a small minority of them.
Okay. It bothers me that you want to tie the two questions together. And I think that I just don't understand why you don't want to separate the question, because if your membership is in the majority, I would think that they're going to ask for the fair share.
Well, Representative Rogers, I think that they have. And I don't think it's any secret here that we're a much stronger organization outside of the Portland School District. And there, we have a majority. They have asked for it. In the larger districts, we've effected a fair share agreement. Mm-hmm. But let me point out a couple of things, though, that number one, contract ratification is not absolutely a requirement now. Mm-hmm. We've had some of our smaller locals particularly that say, look, if these people don't join, they're not going to have anything to say about it. And they have every right to do that by law. We think that all of the people that are involved in this bargaining ought to have some choice in whether they ratify the contract. Now, we also believe that the Legislative Assembly in 1973 set the direction in terms of the ratification, because in 1973 they said that this is something that you will negotiate with management. So you don't negotiate 100% dues necessarily. You negotiate a fair share. And then you also have to negotiate how much that fair share is going to be. Every fair share we have is not 100% of dues. They vary all the way across the board because it's negotiable. And we think it would make almost as much sense to say, okay, if we're going to pull these items separately, maybe we should vote on every article separately. But that wouldn't make any sense because you never would get agreement, because you obviously take some things you don't like in a contract and you give up some other things that you do. And if you have to sit at the bargaining table and this is the bargaining item, and you have to give up things for that, then you have to know whether your organization back here is going to accept it. And that's the key to bargaining, is keeping close tabs to your organization so you know what they're willing to accept and what they're not. Because if you get something thrown back in your face on that, you're in a very difficult position, not only from the standpoint of fair share, but from the standpoint of all the other parts and elements of your contract. So if you say that your people will accept that contract, you'd sure better be right about 99% of the time. And otherwise, you're going to find themselves somebody else to bargain for.
Well, before you go on, let me say that I've just been informed we're going into session at 10 o'clock, and there are two bills that some people have traveled. This bill is going to be set for another hearing. I'm going to ask Mr. Danielson and Mr. Wyatt, and Mr. Telfer are signed up on this bill, and you're not going to testify today, but it'll be set for another hearing. And you can come in at that time, because I'd like the people who have traveled.
Thank you.
Well, I said that I'm going to go through the list for those people who came from out of town. Winnie Francis?
I want to preface this by saying that I'm sorry this wasn't set for an evening hearing. I do understand your problem in trying to do that. But there were quite a few people in Portland who would have liked to have come down and testified, but as I just said, it was a matter of taking vacation time and arranging to take time off from our jobs to do it, and that becomes extremely difficult. So I think you have to assume that there are several people lined up in back of me. My name is Winnie Francis. I work for the State Employment Vision in Portland, and have been an active OSDA member ever since I started working for the state in 1971. In the Employment Division fair share election in February of 1975, I supported the concept of fair share, and I support it now. I have always felt, however, that it should not be the equivalent of dues, but that's not this committee's can of worms, to the best of my knowledge, on this particular amendment. I'm here to testify against this amendment to the fair share statute. There are a lot of state employees who oppose fair share, and I have no idea whether they outnumber us proponents. Their arguments run the gamut from those who say they can't afford it, and I suspect some really can't, to the philosophical stand that nobody, except the government by virtue of its taxing power, has the right to tell people how they must spend their money. I sympathize with both arguments, but the most convincing is that fair share guarantees OSCA a fat income and the power that goes with it, but gives members no guarantee that it will respond to their wishes. OSCA has a tradition of democratic operation, but there have been recent indications that this tradition does not have adequate procedural safeguards even under the present method of voluntary funding. Being relatively new to collective bargaining, OSCA has not yet established a procedure for contract ratification which ensures each employee adequate notification and equal weight in a ratification vote. As an example, at the Health Science Center this past April, 99 employees ratified a contract which binds 2,700 persons. That is not a plurality of 99, but a total vote of 99 in favor of the contract.
May I ask the question?
Yes.
The other people involved just didn't care that much, and they just didn't vote, is that?
Many of them say they never got notice of ratification meetings.
Okay.
In my own unit, I might add, and this is an interpolation of my written statement here, in the office not, which I work in Portland, which is the downtown office of the Employment Service, there are, I think, some 50 or 60 OSCA members, and we had a contract, an agency contract last fall, and that was ratified. The system of ratification was a note passed around the office which said, anybody who objects to this contract, let me know. That was ratification. Fair share is obviously going to be a major determinant of what OSCA will become, because it is, you know, in effect, a closed shop, a union shop, and thus a major determinant in the pattern of relationship between the state and its employees for many years to come. Beyond my own support of the concept of fair share, beyond my own commitment to OSCA, is my abiding belief in democratic processes and the right of state employees to make their own decisions on issues such as fair share, which will have a major impact on their work lives. Including fair share in a contract which may offer highly desirable benefits is automatically waiting the ratification vote on that contract. It is an issue which should stand alone. We need a secret, separate ballot taken prior to negotiation of the issue in a contract, and I think we should seriously consider having that balloting conducted by the Employee Relations Board. The original interpretation of this statute should indeed be clarified by reinforcement of what I take to be the original intent. Now, I want to add to that, I've not got this written, but I'm following up on previous statements that have been made. In the Employment Service offices in Portland, in Multnomah County, I should say, by means of various petitions and informal polling that took place, I can, you know, categorically state that members in Portland are in favor of fair share, but at a reduced rate, somewhere between one-half and two-thirds of membership dues. I should also point out to you, you've listened to a lot of testimony, you've listened to people representing the state, and you've listened to people representing bargaining agents. Please keep in mind that the interests of paid staff and of members do not always coincide.
Ms. Francis.
Yes.
Did you understand what I, when I was talking to the Attorney General, Mr. Hansel, my identification of the issues with that amendment, which one I said would require, as this written amendment is proposed, that collective bargaining agreements, in essence, be ratified by a secret vote of the members. Did you understand that?
Yes, but you're saying it should including a fair share agreement.
Yes.
And we say a fair share agreement must stand alone for a vote, not inside a contract.
Okay.
It has to be extracted from the contractual context.
But as you identified, that there's nothing under the present law, and it appears to be nothing under the present practice of the OSCA, that you actually have a ratification. Am I correct?
There is no
collective bargaining agreement.
That is true, yes. But I'm not quite sure the point you're heading for. But I should point out that this law has been interpreted in the past to mean that there had to be a separate secret ballot on fair share, and that's what we had in the employment service over 2 years ago. A separate secret ballot outside of a contract totally.
I don't think that's true. Because
yes, it is true.
Well, that may have been the practice, but that isn't what the law requires.
Well, it was interpreted apparently as meaning that. Now, I guess the law is open to various interpretations.
No,
from what
the Court of Appeals said that isn't what it means.
Okay. Nevertheless, that's how OSCA interpreted it at the time.
Okay. Do you still understand what I said, that this provision as it's presently written would require that as part of a collective bargaining agreement in which there's a fair share, that there'd have to be notice, there'd have to be an opportunity to vote, there'd have to be an election of the collective bargaining agreement, and a lot of the concerns that you have could be resolved by the fact that the employees could turn out and vote? It would require them to, because as you said, this last time up at the Hill, at the medical school, a lot of employees claimed they hadn't received notice.
Yeah, I reread a sentence from my statement here.
Go ahead.
Including fair share in a contract, in other words, a collective bargaining agreement, which may offer highly desirable benefits, is automatically waiting a ratification vote. In other words, employees will vote for the benefits because they're afraid of what will happen if they vote the contract down, so they vote for the entire contract. And that's what we want to avoid.
Okay. I understand.
Gary. How can I justify the difference between that particular point in the public sector and the private sector? What's different about public employees versus private employees? Because in the private sector, they are ratified all at once. So you tell me how I can answer that question.
I would state, first of all, that the area of public employment, the organization of labor organizations in public employment and labor organizations in private employment are a totally different breed of cat.
They are?
Certainly they are. In private employment, there is a bone of contention, and the bone of contention is who gets the profits, the people who invested the money or the people who invested the labor. And that's not the question in state employment or in any public employment. Everybody, from the governor down, is responsible to the taxpayer. Does that answer your question, sir?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
It's a good argument, so I'll give you credit for that.
Very valid one, yes.
But if I'm paying the tab, you know, I guess if I'm a taxpaying Joe average citizen, I really don't care much if the money's going out of my pocket in taxes or increased prices. If the money's going out of my pocket, it's going out of my pocket. What I want for the money is service.
Right.
And if it's a government service, well, it's going to go out in tax money. If it's a private sector service, it's going to go out in fees, whatever. And, you know, I guess that's the way I would kind of look at it. And I have trouble with this issue because I understand where you're coming from. But by the same token, some of us were involved in the writing of this existing law. And we're finding that most of the public employees really wanted the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, but when it comes to putting it in the same form as the folks in the private sector have, well, now they don't quite want to do that. At least that's my observation.
And, I think so.
And,
yes.
And I, you know, Representative Kulongoski and I may disagree somewhat, but it was always my opinion that if we're going to give public employees collective bargaining, then let's give it to them just the way the private sector's got it. And, you know, I don't see the public employees agreeing with that.
I don't, you know, I have trouble accepting that, because you must automatically transplant the entire method of operation from one sector to the other sector. Just because one part of it fits doesn't mean all of it has to fit.
Well, and I would not dispute that, but I'm trying to determine whether or not this fits or doesn't fit, and I can't see where it does not fit.
I think what public employees, well, I can only talk for the people that I have conversations with and know how they feel. The people I have dealt with in the employment service who are members of OSCA and even non-members One of their major concerns is that they should retain democratic operation of the association. That members should control the association and its policies and how it operates. And I think that what they see is under fair share, they lose the power to do this. The ultimate vote on whether you want your organization or don't want it or like what it's doing is to withdraw your support. Under fair share, you can't do that unless it is only a part of membership.
Okay, let me ask this. Have you seen the executive department's proposed amendment?
I saw it this morning, but I didn't have a chance really to look at it and understand its implications, so I wouldn't want to comment on it.
I'd be interested. I don't expect you to travel down here again on another vacation day, but if you'd write me a note, I'd appreciate it, because I'd really like to know before the next hearing how you feel about those amendments.
Okay, I will do that.
Because you see, if this bill passed in its current form, it would not be making the private sector and the public sector the same. It would be giving, well, I won't use the term of who would have an advantage or not, but it would not be the same. Now, with the amendments proposed by the executive department included in the bill, then it would be, as near as I can tell, pretty near the same.
Does that provide for a separate secret ballot outside of a contract? I think that's what the public employees I know would like to see.
Well, this would provide for the same way it is in the private sector, basically where you would ratify the contract, which may or may not contain the fair share agreement, but then it would also give you the procedure by which you could petition to get out from under the fair share agreement.
No, I think that what, the state employees who are watching this bill, this amendment, this is precisely what they're upset about, that it should not be included in a contract. They want a separate, secret ballot on fair share. If it's included in a contract, then let for purposes of voting, extract it from the contract.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gary, I would tell you that the recent case that everyone's talking about, Abood, the specific question you ask was argued as to whether there is a distinction as far as union security between the public and the private sector.
And the noble justices said.
The noble justices said there is no difference whatsoever on this issue. This is one issue that they said that they do not distinguish between the public or the private sector.
Nice to know that the Supreme Court and I agree on something.
Roberta Barnhouse. Okay, I was going to call Lee Springer. There's another state employment bill that you'll probably want to sit here and listen to. I doubt if you're signed up. You're not signed up for it, but you may be interested in it. Lee Springer?
I'm local also.
Okay, Lee. The clerk notes that, Jane?
Yes.
You do note on the tape Roberta Barnhouse, Lee Springer, Bill Wyatt, and Steve Telfer. They have, Roberta, if you would tell the clerk your address and everything, that she will inform you at the next time of the hearing, and leave her your phone number, so if in case at this late part of the session that we get caught, we have to give you a call. I'm going to close the hearing on 474 at this particular time and open up the hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 727. Larry Dixon. Mr. Hazleton. The session is going to start at 10, and I doubt if we're going to get to you today. You're going to have to try again.
Be back.
Okay. Heck, you keep you're opposed to the bill as long as it keeps being sent back. You're ready. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Larry Dixon. I reside in Salem. I'm an employee of the Department of Revenue as a revenue agent. I would like to first state that I'm here as an individual, not as a representative of the Department of Revenue or any association or group of people. Senate Bill 727 would be a bill that would protect state employees from unfair actions of the executive department. I would like to give you a little background on the reason Senate Bill 727 was introduced. The Department of Revenue, some months ago, possibly a year ago, requested the executive department to do a study on the revenue agent series. There's three grades of revenue agents, 1, 2, and 3. The executive department completed its study and said that their findings indicated that the group of people with the Department of Revenue and one or two others in other agencies had more complicated and additional duties as revenue agents than people with, say, Welfare Division has revenue agents. Their people have been classified as Revenue Agent 1s and Revenue Agent 2s. The findings of the Executive Department indicated that the agents with the Department of Revenue had more complex and additional duties than those people. There's revenue agents with the PUC and approximately 8 other agencies. The findings by Executive Department state that new classification specifications for this series have been written and did take effect June 1. The result of these new specifications means that a number of agents in this series will be demoted, in fact, to one lesser grade. Most of the people with the Department of Revenue will be left at their present rating, which is the 1, 2, or 3 level, myself being a 3. Our feeling is that this is really unfair to our people who have, over a period of years, obtained additional duties and responsibilities as revenue agents. This has been recognized by the executive department, and what they're telling us, in fact, is that, great, you've got more duties, more responsibilities, and what we're going to do is leave you alone and demote everybody else. Please excuse my nervousness this morning.
Mr. Dixon,
I'd be nervous if I was in front of you, so.
Yeah.
That make you feel better.
The committee understands exactly what the purpose of this bill is. If you're in a specific job classification on the merit system right now, can they down classify you at any time without giving you a hearing and everything like that?
My understanding is that they can as a group, the whole classification. They did a study on the entire classification, not one individual. Their findings indicated that revenue agents did not have, or say a revenue agent 3 in one department did not have equal duties and responsibilities of a revenue agent in another department. Therefore, they rewrote the specifications of that revenue agent, say 3 series, to fit the highest level of competence. Then they evaluated the positions at all levels of revenue agent 3.
Now, when you say the positions, you're actually talking about the individuals in the positions.
They reevaluated the individuals after they made the new specifications for the entire series.
When you say they evaluated the positions after that, you mean they evaluated the individuals to see if, in fact, that they had the skill or training required, in their opinion, to hold that 3 position.
Not necessarily the skill or training, but just what they, after they wrote the new specifications, they evaluated the duties, not necessarily the skill and training, of the position held by that person.
Okay. You're not talking about the individual's ability in this bill, are you?
I'm not talking about the job function
that individual performs.
That's correct. The job function.
Okay. It's two different ideas. One is whether the individual has the ability to perform that position, which Mr. Dixon is not saying that this bill addresses. It's whether the actual performance of the job actually meets the job specs that position that they have reevaluated as. So it isn't a very personal thing. It's a question over the whole class.
That's correct. That's it.
Okay.
And I don't want to limit it just to our series, because it's a thing that I think we're going to see evolve over years to come, and it's going to happen in all phases of state government. I'm just using the revenue agency series because that's the one I'm involved in, and that's the one that's
brought to our attention. So if I can put this in different terms.
Sure.
This bill addresses the question if there is a reorganization and a reclassification of a particular job. Doesn't it? Isn't that what you're talking about? And whether, in fact, that after the reclassification, if you were somehow going to be frozen at a lower classification or downgraded from the present position you hold as a class?
Well, the idea is there. I don't necessarily agree with the...
Okay, go ahead.
Let me try to say it again. What has been said by the executive department, in my opinion, is that if they do a study on a series, the revenue agent series in this instance, and they feel that there is an inequity between the duties performed by one revenue agent, three, say with the Department of Revenue, and a revenue agent three with PUC or welfare, that they are going to rewrite the classification specifications for a revenue agent three, which they have done. They raised, if you will, the competence necessary and the amount of duties, the details of duties to become a revenue agent three, so that the people in the other agencies cannot qualify under the new specifications. So therefore, they're being demoted. And again, my understanding is that this took effect June 1. I don't know if notices have been received by these employees.
Larry, let me pour you in. Don Pierre, are you here?
Yes.
Why don't you come up and Larry, stay right there.
Sure.
I want you to sit next to him. Mr. Pierre is with the executive department, and I would like for you to clarify the questions that I was asking, because I read this bill basically to say that you can't have a reclassification if it results in a downgrading of a position.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Don Pierre. I'm with the Executive Department Personnel Division. Basically, what we believe that this particular bill does is prevent any downward reduction of classes of work. Now, it's introduced a factor of competence, and in the testimony I'd plan to give you, we have considerable difficulty with that because we're grappling with the same ambiguities that I think members of the committee are. That is, are we talking about employee performance? Are we talking about minimum qualifications or recruiting requirements, or just what we're? I don't know how to deal with that particular concept because we deal with positions. We deal with the work that's there to be done and are not looking at the employee who's doing it. That's up to their employer, their boss.
Okay. Let me ask a question. I got lost somewhere back down the road on this thing. Now, with the change in the positions, the classifications, and so that I know where we're starting from, is a one higher than a three? Or
three is the top level.
Three is the higher the number... the higher the position
in this series. Yes.
In this series. Is that true with other series too?
I would summarize the effects of this if I may.
Well, let me finish asking my question first. Now, they changed the job description so that it fits your job over in the revenue department, but it doesn't fit the job that's being performed in the welfare division. And are those people now then will be considered as revenue agent twos instead of threes, or ones instead of twos?
Well, if I could...
Just yes or no?
I really can't address it in that
the answer is
Representative
yes.
Rogers.
Well,
we've got 105 revenue agents in the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
We've got 11 agencies that use them. We've got three levels identified for the kinds of work that are being performed by revenue agents. These are collection people.
Okay, now you've got 105 revenue agents with 11 agencies using.
That's correct.
And what was the other figure that you had some more figures?
Well, the
the fact that we have three levels that we use to identify the various degrees of...
All right.
Now, what we've done is to go out throughout state service, finding those jobs that are engaged in the collections business, non-supervisor, I might say, non-supervisor, and then finding out just exactly what they're doing and how it relates to what others are doing in the same business. We found that, again, there were three levels of work, but we couldn't make the same three cuts that we made many years ago when the existing series was devised. We found that there were still three levels, but we found that because of some rather ambiguous class specifications, some fuzzy criteria, and some, I would imagine, some job classes that were done as a matter of expediency at one time or another, there were many, many jobs that were up in the higher ranks that didn't want being up in the higher ranks in that class series, and there were some jobs, as in the revenue department itself, that stood out above what was happening in other agencies. So it was a realignment throughout the entire state of these 105 jobs. There was no foregone conclusion that we'd cut back on anything.
Did you add any other classifications other than 1, 2, or 3?
Did you add any?
Yeah.
No.
You just rearranged them with the...
That's correct.
Now,
excuse me. I'll be more accurate. There were some positions... And I say this with some egg on my face. There were some positions that were classified in a lower level of administrative assistant that were filled by some women, and those jobs were doing every bit of the work that was being performed by revenue agents in other locations. Those positions we've stuck in the revenue agent series.
So the pay is commensurate with the grade.
We believe so.
A 1 is lower paid than a 2, and a 2
yes,
lower
correct.
Paid than a 3.
That's correct.
That's a good assumption. All right. Now, when you reclassified these revenue agents over in the welfare division, was their pay level frozen, or was it cut back?
Their pay level was frozen in all of these circumstances.
Okay.
Wherever there's a drop back, it's frozen.
Okay, it's frozen. Now, what... So that means that you've got a 2 now being paid the same as a 3 in the revenue department.
Now, that occurs, sir.
Okay, but it must occur.
No, I'd like to, if I could, present a couple of factors that I think seriously influence the discussion here. Incidentally, in the interest of
Don, what I was going to do is I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood that what the bill did. What I'd like to do is to have these people who have come in here from out of town testify, because you can always come over here.
Okay.
Could I do that, Bill?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Larry, go ahead. I understand what they're doing.
You want me to remain? Okay.
No, you can leave right now. I understand what you're talking about now.
Okay. Really, the only point that I make that bothers me that I wish the committee to understand is the fact that I feel, and other revenue agents in the state feel this way, and I have talked to a number of them, that it's not right for, and these specifications have stood for maybe 10 years, and they've just now been reevaluated. Over this period of time, the legislature has changed tax laws, added new tax programs, so naturally the workload and the competence of revenue agents with the Department of Revenue has had to increase. We've had to learn new tax laws. We've had to learn new programs. And the executive department is telling us, and I better qualify this, but it's not just the Department of Revenue. There's a few other positions that are also threes besides with the Department of Revenue. But the majority of them with the Department of Revenue will remain unchanged. The burden is being placed on those outside the Department of Revenue. They're the ones that are taking the brunt of this action by the Executive Department. There may be only one or two positions in the Department of Revenue out of, I believe, 50-some revenue agents that are being demoted. What is happening is they're telling us that with the greater workload that we now have, the greater confidence that we have to have, they're leaving us at the top level of the three, and the other people who haven't had as great of increase in their workload and competence are being demoted.
It's just not fair to them. I've only been a state employee for a couple of years, but if I'd been around for 10 years in one of these other positions and done a good job, and I feel I do a good job now with the Department of Revenue, and all of a sudden the study's done, and because people in another department have had their workload increased, they're going to demote me. It just doesn't make any sense. Some of these people that have been with these other departments for a number of years are looking at a wage freeze for a couple of years. They're not going to receive a cost of living increase. They're not going to receive any merit increases. And they're going to be froze until the system, through increases, catches up to them before they receive any type of increase at all.
In other words, they didn't reduce. They're not going to take a reduction in their current salary.
I believe the term is a red circle, a red line. They're frozen that pay level until the system catches up with them. There's a number of pay grades in any position, and a lot of these people are at the top level. And, or if, even if they're one step down from the top level, when they reach that top level, they can't go any higher until the system catches up with them. But and the testimony that we heard previously on the other bill, one of the representatives mentioned that he thought the state system should be compared to the public system. Well, it certainly wouldn't happen this way if we were in the public system. People wouldn't be demoted. The people that had the additional duties would they'd find a new level and they would be increased.
Yeah. In the private.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Can I make
Yeah, go ahead. Go right ahead.
I disagree with that last statement. The reason I disagree with it is from experience. I work at the electrical trade as a construction electrician. We're the ones receiving the premium pay or the higher pay classification. But when we reach a situation where we can't perform to fill that responsibility, or if the jobs aren't there, we certainly take a cut in pay if we want to continue being employed. We either go into the maintenance, into a shop where we're doing maintenance, which might be two-thirds of the construction pay, or if there's any ships in the Portland Harbor that need marine electricians, we go into that field just because it's the only job available.
Right. Okay.
Many times, unfortunately, due to age and the inability to acquire new skills and all, we take, sure, we might have the blue card in our pocket, but we also take jobs that pay less.
Right. Well, Representative, I would agree with you on an individual case-by-case position evaluation that this may be true if the person doesn't have the confidence, but we're talking about a whole series. We're not talking about one individual. If that individual, for some reason, his particular job, one job has changed, we're talking about a whole series where a group in that series' confidence has had to increase to keep up with their job over a period of years. Now, if they left the description the same for the top level and said that people below that level were not doing that, then I wouldn't have the arguments that I have. But they have rewritten the duties and the responsibilities at the top level and say that again, these people with the Department of Revenue fulfill that, but the people in the top level with other agencies don't fill it, so they're going to demote them. They've changed the top level, and well, it changed all three levels, but the top level has been increased so the people that previously held it no longer can. See the distinction that I'm making from the point that you made. I agree with what you said, that if there's one job that over a period of time, for some reason, the duties have been decreased, then that person may well deserve a reduction if he's not carrying that load anymore. But it's just gone the opposite way. People have had their workload increased, and they're being demoted.
Thank you,
Larry. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm doing this. I've got a question, but this whole thing puzzles me. I don't know enough about it to make a statement, but I'm going to make it anyway. I would think that someone in the revenue department would have to have a different set of skills. I don't care whether they're called revenue agents, one, two, or three, or whatever, but they would have to have some different set of skills than someone over in the welfare department that's trying to recover monies. And I'm a little concerned about us getting into the statutes and start tinkering around here. And what I want to know when Ms. Pearl comes back again is just how this is all handled administratively. Is it all, surely it's not all handled in the statute. What are we doing dealing with the statutes or something in an area that probably should be handled administratively?
You know, I take it the whole argument, Bill, in this whole area is a moral argument in the sense that you have a guy here that has done everything that he's supposed to do in the job, and for reasons beyond his control, and he has no influence over whether it's the fact that the workload diminishes or something happens. A guy who has been performing this job, has been a very faithful employee, all of a sudden finds himself into an administrative reorganization as far as a particular classification, and then all of a sudden he's rewarded by being down classified, and it has nothing to do with his own subjective abilities because he's being looked at in the whole class. And I take Mr. Dixon's concern, and he, you know what I'm amazed at is you seem not to be one of the people that were downgraded.
No, my position is left as it was,
but you're concerned about the other people that you caught.
Right, and, you know.
And then the future that it may happen to you one day.
Okay, now, can that revenue agent two over in the welfare division transfer over to the revenue department?
He could put his name in to request the lateral transfer over.
Okay.
No guarantee that he would be brought over, but he has the same right as anyone to request it. In fact, that's the way I came to the Department of Revenue. I was a revenue agent, two with the Public Welfare Division when I started with the state. And I requested the lateral transfer, and when the position came open, I was interviewed and was hired with the Department of Revenue.
If someone over there who effectively is trapped wants to get out of that trap, he has a way out of the trap, doesn't he?
He has a way out, but it is limited by the positions that are available.
Sure.
But we're not talking about just the Public Welfare Division now. We're talking about those other nine agencies.
Mm-hmm. But there's, now, this must happen with some frequency in all sectors, either private or public sectors, where things change, and as a result, somebody gets caught.
I would agree that it must happen. I don't know about the frequency of it, but I'm probably looking at it from a little different standpoint that I haven't expressed. My personal feeling is that the level should have been left alone, and possibly a revenue agent four level should have been added. If the confidence of the top level has increased, the people at the top level should have been raised, not that everybody else demoted.
Larry,
let me ask you a question.
But that's another case.
Doesn't this bill, you have job protection, and in education it's called tenure, so I'm going to keep referring to that, but you have tenure now under the state merit system as far as a state employee, don't you? That's more of a statement than it is a question to you. And what this bill actually does is not only gives you tenure as an individual, but it also gives you tenure in a particular job classification. That if you work in that classification, you're hired into it, and for some unforeseen circumstances in the future, that job classification changes. What this bill says is that you've got some job right in that particular classification, and they can't downgrade you.
Yes, and we're saying that in this bill, in the whole series now.
Yeah,
now
it's a class. Right,
that's correct.
It's a class. The whole class has tenure of position as distinguished from tenure of employment.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
But I would still think that the executive department would have the right on an individual basis.
No,
if they could say that Larry Dixon's position is the duties have been diminished, that they would still have a right on an individual basis to change
just
my
tenure
position.
Tenure position as a class, though,
right,
rather than an individual.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The session starts. Ms. Gilmore, Mr. Stevens, and Mr. George,
that you all want to testify on behalf of this bill. It's obvious, it's a difficult concept for the committee to just pick up when they read the bill, and I probably have worked in this area more than they have, and I had difficulty reading the bill and understanding exactly what you were trying to accomplish out of it. It's going to be set for another hearing. If you would call probably later this afternoon, and I will have a definite time that it's going to be set. Or that if you would leave your numbers with the committee clerk, we'll see that we get in touch with you and let you know. Mr. Wyatt? Okay. It's difficult to just understand exactly what you're trying to accomplish. Mr. Wyatt, the one question I have is the federal government requires the state to meet certain standards of a merit system to, I don't know, is it federal funding that they get? Would you let me know if this particular concept of job reclassification falls within the ambit of that act? Okay. Could you then come back to the committee and explain that to us? Bill, we're not picking you up on it. Okay, I will make a point to get you together. I'm going to close the hearing on 7:27. I'd like to open up the hearing very quickly to Senate Bill 882. Have you seen this bill? This is the bill we had a hearing on the other day. And Representative, it had to do with the electrical contractors and the reasons they can revoke the license. And Representative Otto, as you recall, there was no dissent to the bill, and Representative Otto has a motion to move the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Wait a second.
You have the motion. Is there any discussion? I'll let you find it.
It's a consumer protection bill that says that if a electrical contractor hires someone to do electrical work, that person must be a licensed electrician. Otherwise, that contractor is subject to having his license revoked or suspended. The contractor is putting people out on the job, passing them off as licensed electricians, carrying the price tag of a licensed electrician, and then quite often he is hiring non-licensed help. And it's a very good bill. Protection of the consumer, and it's much needed.
Yes, Representative Rogers.
What can be done now if an individual contractor hires someone who is not qualified?
They can just ask for removal of the person from that person's place of employment. In other words, it's against the law to do electrical work unless you're licensed. The burden is on the employee to prove that he is licensed.
This is rather a remedy to the existing law that says
right.
They can't do that already, as I understand it.
I'm going to have to oppose the
Al?
Motion. It puts a pretty heavy penalty on
this. Well, I'm not in favor of it.
Okay. Then I will withdraw the motion. Representative Lindquist. Okay. Is there any further discussion? Is there hearing none? The clerk will call the roll. This is on the due pass of Senate Bill 882 to the floor.
Get out of the way of that train.
Senate Bill 882.
Senate Bill 882. Authorizes cancellation or suspension of license issued to electrical contractor if electrical advisory board finds the contractor has employed unlicensed persons to make electrical installations. As you may recall, Representative Lindquist, this is the bill that I discussed with you that said that it was actually providing a remedy to the present provision in the law that says this practice is unlawful. You know, call the roll, please.
Representative Lindquist, aye.
Aye.
Representative Otto? Aye. Representative Riebel?
No.
Representative Rogers?
No.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelms is excused?
Yes.
And Chairperson Kulongoski?
Aye. Senate Bill 882 is sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Otto will carry that bill.
May I ask the two licensed, and I assume they are licensed, maybe I've been going under the wrong assumption, insurance agents whether or not they feel that unlicensed people should sell insurance?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It ain't theirs to me.
Hearing, is there anything else to come before the committee? The committee will note that there's a hearing starting at 7 o'clock tonight, and I assured you that it would end at 10, and that it will end at 10, because I have to go to Eugene tonight again. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.